How many kinds of sweet flowers grow in an English country garden? I'll tell you now of some that I know, and those I miss you'll surely pardon.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The number of flowers or trees or other plantings in an English garden are one thing. That's just a list. But the definition of such a garden and its influence on the American gardening tradition, now, that takes a book. Joining us now by phone from Quincy, Massachusetts, to talk about his new book, America's Romance with the English Garden, is author Thomas Mickey. Tom is a graduate of Harvard University's Landscape Institute. He has been a garden columnist for several publications, and he's a retired professor at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Good morning, Ann.
Let's start with the definition of the English garden. It's really a moving target. You said the meaning dates to the 19th century, but English gardening, of course, predates that. It came from somewhere.
Well, it certainly predates the 19th century, but when you talk about it, you always have to lock in a time period, because then you can see visually and also read about what the garden looked like at that particular time. And the 19th century came after the time that the lawn became the preeminent, in the 18th century, the preeminent symbol of the English garden, the long, expansive lawn going from the walls of the estate to the almost the ends of the property. So, and that's really important, because that symbol of the lawn kind of moved into the 19th century as well.
English history is overlaid as well with the history of horticulture. I mean, they took their plants very seriously.
Yes, they did. And they, especially in the 18th century, they had plant collectors traveling the world to Asia, to Africa, to, of course, the Americas. Some of our plants found a great home in English gardens at that time. And they weren't terribly accepted here. Like, for example, I love this plant in my own garden, the black-eyed Susan. That's a great plant that everybody knows, but in England in the 1700s, it was a very popular plant, and it had a hard time in the 19th century, 100 years later, getting any acceptance here, because it was a native plant, and people didn't want native plants unless the English had grown it first. Then they liked it.
It's an interesting point. What influenced the English? What caught their fancy? They had lots of nearby influences from being in closer to Western Europe and among all kinds of travelers at the time.
I think a turning point is the early 1700s, when the English equated gardening with painting and aligned it with poetry as an art form. That moved the whole idea of landscape design into a completely different direction. Now you could create a view outside your home, just like the painter would create a beautiful canvas of trees and shrubs and lawn and stone and water and so forth. That was really the turning point, when landscape design was taken seriously by lots of people at lots of levels, politicians, philosophers, poets, all kinds of people. To me, that's really an important time.
Where did landscape designers come from? When did they emerge in England? We think of the English gardener, the guy that's taking care of everything,
right?
But who designed all of that?
Well, there were always English, as we would say today, landscape designers. They didn't call them that. In the 18th century, they were called landscape gardeners.
Okay.
And that term emerged as well into the 19th century. The word designer and architect are all late 19th century words that were introduced, because they were trying to make that field, especially here in America at that point, a profession. And so it became more crystallized as landscape architecture at the end of the 19th century. But there were always people who, in the 1700s in England, who would design these gardens, these beautiful gardens, and they would do sketches, and then other people would install them. Of course, the landscape gardeners didn't actually do the work. They just sketched it on paper, and then somebody else, a team of other people, would come in and do the work.
My guest is Tom Mickey. He's the author of a new book. It's called America's Romance with the English Garden. If you want to talk about the influence of the English garden on your garden or American gardens, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We do have a Facebook question from Ben. He asks if the plantain arrived here from England.
I'm not sure about that plant. I know that it was very popular in England, so I can't address that one, but that's a great question.
Going back to what influenced the English, they were for a time influenced by the French, although maybe they wouldn't have admitted it at the time.
Yes, you're
the,
right.
The topiaries and the hedges and those kind of things, that was more French in influence.
It was French and also Dutch.
Okay.
The formal design, which was really important in the 1600s, was a combination of what the French were doing, because everybody loved Le Notre's Versailles and were trying to imitate that, and also the Dutch with their extremely trimmed shrubs was a very popular format. So before the 1700s, the English garden was quite formal, and that's you can see even today at Hampton Court. In London, you can see that design from the 1600s. But then there was a rebellion, there was a political rebellion in the early 1700s, which was expressed in the landscape as well. People didn't want this old formality. They wanted what was called the new style, which was more natural, and that included, of course, the lawn.
I'd also like to invite listeners to post photographs of your garden on our Facebook page if you'd like. I posted a photograph of my garden on Facebook, so if you want to follow suit, please do. We'd love to see it. What better thing is there to look at than a garden? Literature. I tried to find cuts from movies was my first endeavor. I ended up going with music, but there are so many references to the garden in any kind of English literature. You made me think of an Austen phrase when in Pride and Prejudice, when you know the someone says, "I see you have a pretty little wilderness out, you know, at the side of your house." I could go on and on and on, right off the top of my head, between E.M. Forster, Jane Austen, you name it. Gardens were a big part of the backdrop.
Exactly. That's why some of those are filmed in the historic estates in England. But the early 19th century kind of locked in what the format of the garden was to be for the rest of the century. And that Tom Carter, who's a great English garden historian, said that the hallmark elements of the English garden in the early 19th century were first the lawn, then the curved walkways or pathways, usually in gravel, and then trees to line the property, and then groupings of flowering shrubs, three in a group. So when you looked at the house, you saw mostly just the lawn, and you saw groups of shrubs here and there, and then trees to line the property. Very much like Downton Abbey. That's Highclere Castle. When you look at Downton Abbey, all you see is the castle-like structure and the grass in front of it, and that's a relic, really, of the 1700s.
And then the gardens, as we perceive them, are closer to the house, more private.
Correct. And the vegetable garden, the vegetable patch, or herbs, kitchen garden, those were all terms for the same thing, were always behind the house and away from view of visitors. So you never, for example, put that in the front. You always put that behind the house. Washington and Jefferson loved the English garden style. And at Mount Vernon, you can see that vegetable garden, the herb garden, over on the side of the house. You can't even notice because it's hidden by trees, but it has a tall red brick wall all around it to protect it from the winds and also rodents. But that was the English style, where you would have it close to the house but not visible to people who were visiting you.
And also, when I was reading your chapter about Williamsburg, it's surrounded, it's protected. It's because a lot of it's food, and it had to be protected.
Exactly. And that Williamsburg example tells us that the English gardened at that time in the old tradition of the formal garden. The governor's garden, for example, at Williamsburg, governor's palace, is done in the old formal style, which by that time when it was actually put up, the English themselves were rejecting that formal style and going into the more picturesque. But it certainly is a wonderful example of the evolution of garden design or landscape gardening at Williamsburg.
When it comes to early America, having flowers was quite a luxury, wasn't it? And they didn't perceive native plants as garden plants. So, but like flowers in general were extra.
Exactly. But people did grow flowers. Mm-hmm. People did have gardens like that. But for the most part, until the 1850s, 1860s industrialization, most people in America were just concerned with surviving, with growing food and vegetables just to put on the table. So, and most people were farmers, of course. It was only in the estates outside big cities like Philadelphia, New York, Boston, where wealthy people could have these extensive gardens very much that reflected the English style of that time, that picturesque style. But the ordinary people didn't have gardens as we now know them or landscapes as we now know them with lawn and flower beds and shrubs until really the 1860s, 1870s when advertising began and industrialization and people moved to suburbs.
Early Americans who wanted an English garden, how did they know what to do? Were there books back then?
There certainly were books, and they were the English books. People read these books. There were a couple of American authors who wrote about gardening, but for the most part, there was a great dependence on English garden books, especially in the period of Williamsburg, for example. Those were the books that people looked at, and those were the ways that taught people how to garden. But by the mid-19th century, more American horticulturalists were writing books themselves. But what happened was even garden magazines in America at that time reflected the style and content of English garden magazines. So even in literature, in writing about the garden, there was a keen dependence on the English model.
So it got really, really competitive in England, and it is as it does here. I think it's the number one hobby in the United States.
It is,
and in England as well, right?
It is. It's the number one. I was in England a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to somebody about his garden. He said, "Oh, I love my garden. I'm obsessed with my lawn." Which really shocked me. And I said, today you're really obsessed with your lawn with all the drain on water. Of course, the English don't have that issue of water, that problem of water because of the climate in most of England. But whereas in this country we do, but we still love the lawn and want to cultivate the lawn. People spend more money on lawn care today than any other expense for the landscape.
In England, the Horticulture Society took off in the 19th century as well, and it was the wealthy, as everything else you've mentioned, who started those clubs. What were they trying to achieve?
Well, that's really a great question. They were trying to bond together to promote horticulture because before that, horticulture was part of agriculture, and they wanted to show that growing flowers and flowering shrubs and growing trees just to look at them without having any fruit come from them is a good and noble thing to do, and especially as the societies evolved for the middle class. So even though these societies, like the one in Boston, were started by rather wealthy horticulturalists who owned businesses in Boston, but they had this hobby, eventually middle class people became part of that movement of horticulture. So they would go to their yearly shows, for example, in the great exhibit halls of Boston. They would have these shows in the fall to show dahlias and chrysanthemums, in the spring to show spring bulbs. And lots of people went to those. And it was a way of, in a sense, of democratizing gardening, making it something that everybody could do. It was great for that reason.
My guest is Tom Mickey. He's the author of a new book. It's called America's Romance with the English Garden. If you have a question or comment for Tom, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to post a picture of your garden on our Facebook page, that would be delightful. Just check it out and post your picture there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Support comes from ARC Industries, creating employment opportunities for people with disabilities and helping businesses grow their own inclusive workforce. ARC is dedicated to the success of its customers and employees and believes our community is at its best when we're all working together. Online at arcind.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a conversation with a former Lehman Brothers banker who is starting his new life as a doctor.
I can say that what I did greatly impacted the life or lifestyle of another human being directly, whereas working in finance, kind of the end result is more money in somebody's pocket.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon from 2 till 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Explore the incredible career of an American hero born in Ohio on John Glenn, A Life of Service, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
I know. Any excuse to play the Downton Abbey theme. Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're talking about the English garden and the English garden influence on American gardening tradition with the author of a new book. His name is Thomas Mickey, and the new book is called America's Romance with the English Garden. If you have a question or comment for Thomas, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Once again, post a picture of your garden on our Facebook page if you can. It would be great to see everybody's examples. Going back to that question from Ben on Facebook, we did get a response from Ange on Facebook who says, plantain is a native plant. The plantain lily is the Asian relative, also known as hosta. So there you go.
Wonderful.
Bulla in Delaware, you're on the air with Tom Mickey. Welcome, Bulla.
Hi. I wanted to ask whether the fad of having a little ruin or a little hermitage on the back lawn or in some shrubbery, whatever took, I know it existed in England, but did it ever transplant over to America?
Tell me what you mean by a little ruin.
They would build like a ruin. They would build a house that was ruined.
Okay.
Or a little medieval-looking structure, a chapel or something,
okay,
that was ruined.
Okay.
As far as I could see from the material that I read about in the garden here in America in the 19th century, that did not take off. I'm familiar with it from the English tradition. I think the reason that was the case that didn't take off, people were concerned here with much smaller properties. The acreage was usually much smaller, and so people wanted a middle-class house with a lawn, and that element didn't really take off, I don't think.
Thank you, Bulla, for that question. There were some influences from outside of England or influences on England. Italian, we mentioned French earlier, but Italian, they were into the fountains and that sort of thing.
Yes, the Italian design is really famous for the fountains, for the exposures of water, the bubbling and so forth. And that was really an important ingredient in spreading their design around the world, really. In fact, we have in this country Longwood Gardens outside of Philadelphia, which represents that design. And that's what you see at Versailles, a lot of that at Versailles, fountains in Le Nôtre's design, their very formal design. So, but that certainly was important. It was familiar to people. But what we borrowed from that in the 19th century here was the need to have a water feature of some sort, if you could, on your property. And some of the seed companies and nurseries would talk about that, the importance of a water feature, because that tells the visitor to your garden that you are serious about landscaping.
A lot of your interest in this subject stems from your scholarly work on the influence of advertising and mass media. You said that 19th century American gardeners were the first ever to experience the mass marketing of the garden. How so? Was it just the seed catalogs?
Well, it was the seed and nursery catalogs were pioneers in selling products to people across the country. They really indicate how Sears and Montgomery Ward would later on sell their wares. And it was a very important marketing tool for them. But as the century wore on, for example, in 1875, one company in New York, the Childs Company sent out 750 catalogs, seed catalogs, in 1875. By 1896, his company sent out almost 1.5 million catalogs. And the reason they could do that was, first of all, printing, the capability of printing in a new format came about, a linotype, the typewriter was introduced, and cheap printing, cheap paper was introduced, and of course it was free rural mail delivery, which the seed companies were really great at orchestrating in Washington. That also enabled that. But in terms of advertising, this is what I found. I found that by the early 1800s, magazines in this country were sold not because they had great articles in them, but because they could sell their subscribers to potential advertisers, people who had clothing or shoes to sell. For example, Ladies' Home Journal subsisted only on its advertising. Its articles were secondary. And so for the first time, people were sold across the country the same kind of advertising that appeared in these magazines from coast to coast. And the products were generally then what was called standardized. And that's what I refer to as mass media, a message sent from one end of the country to the other.
What was the first seed catalog? Is it what we think of as a seed catalog now, or were they just flyers? Or
yeah, I think flyers is a great way to describe them. They were very simple printed sheets of what the merchant had to sell, and it was usually just a few pages. And there was very little artwork. It was just lists, and that predates 1830. By 1830, the catalog became a little bit bigger because by then we had newspapers. We had penny newspapers, so it was quite cheap then to do very, not elaborate, but little thicker catalogs. But by the end of the century, not only did we have all that printing capability, we also had chromolithography enter the scene, which was a great art form for businesses where an artist would create some kind of selling image for the company, and that would appear on trade cards or on the catalogs. And therefore, we had these beautiful, beautiful catalogs, which are today really considered artwork.
Often featuring women or children.
Exactly. And that was the primary target market was women for these catalogs, especially after 1870. Women were the primary shoppers for the home. They bought everything for the home. And so they would often appear on the catalog cover and also inside from time to time. And then there were often children featured on the cover and in articles inside. For example, Mr. Vick, who had his company in Rochester, New York, had a wonderful column in his garden catalog called For the Little Ones. He always had a couple of essays for them so they would feel at home in gardening. So they were also an important audience for the catalogs.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the English garden influence on the American gardening tradition with Tom Mickey, the author of a new book, America's Romance with the English Garden. The catalog writers had a very special job. They had a real sell job on their hands. They had to sell the seeds and the lifestyle. And the catalog writers were the owners. I mean, they took it very personally.
Yes, they were really, really quite proud about what they wrote. I remember visiting the W. Attlee Burpee residence. It's still there outside of Philadelphia in a town called Doylestown. That's where he tested his seeds, what he called his trial garden. And his house, his farmhouse, is still there. When I was visiting it, I walked into his den or office area, which had a huge fireplace, and in the corner was this big desk, big wooden desk. And over at the other corner, I saw a door. And I asked the tour guide that day, I said, what does that door do? Where does that go? He said, well, that goes up to the bedroom. And if in the night Mr. Burpee had an inspiration for his catalog, he would come down the steps to his desk and jot down that idea lest he forget it.
It was a great new market for artists, too, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes. In Rochester, New York, for example, there were several companies who specialized in horticultural artwork. And they eventually, in the early 1890s, created a magazine, which didn't last very long. It was a glorious magazine with a lot of these illustrations in them. So, and they did sometimes the same catalog the same company would use the same image that another company had, simply because it was cheaper to do that than have one made just for you. So sometimes they were sold to various companies. But that was really important. But there were a lot of companies using chromolithography to promote their products. And then they would encourage you to write in to get a chromolithograph of their flowers that you could frame and put up in your living room. Mr. Vick was famous about this. He had a chromolithograph that was 18 inches by 24. And if you sent in 25 cents, you could get this chromolithograph and frame it and put it up in your living room or your dining room. And this was middle-class art. This was the great thing about chromolithography. It democratized itself as an art form for everybody. So you didn't just have to be wealthy, rather, to have artwork. Anybody could have artwork. That was a great feature.
And by now, gardening and the garden style of the English garden is a sign of relative wealth. It's a sign of middle class.
Exactly. Remember I said earlier that the estate owners outside these big cities like Philly, even Chicago, Philly, Boston, would have these big estates, often in the English garden design, like estates in England.
Mm-hmm.
And by the middle of the century, that idea of having these lawns was really attractive to middle-class people, because in the marketing from these seed and nursery companies saying, now you could have a lawn just like so-and-so or just like the estates, not saying precisely in those terms, but in that kind of message. So it became a kind of a symbol of social status. I remember in Vick's catalog, this is a line that I remember almost by heart. He said, what we do in the gardening way is done for the appearance, the respectability of the thing, done for the same reason that we have a coat of paint put on the house or renew the wall hangings. So it was so people could see what kind of class you belong to.
If you have a question or comment for Tom Mickey, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. When did exotic plant varieties begin to outnumber native varieties in England?
Well, they were always a great part of their gardens, their collections. Exotic plants from China, from South America, from Africa. These plants that we really couldn't grow, or they couldn't grow in that kind of climate, as they would put them in the greenhouses for the summer. For the winter, that was very common. And exotics were really important in the garden. Some people had hundreds or thousands of these plants in their gardens. So native plants in America became very difficult to sell, because we wanted these exotic plants that England was growing, England was showing in their own gardens. And eventually we got those, and then finally, probably towards the end of the 19th century, we got our own native plants back, as it were. I remember a wonderful quote from Thomas Meehan. Thomas Meehan is one of my favorite characters from the 19th century. He was a Philadelphia nurseryman, and he had a magazine called Gardener's Monthly, which he published for 30 years, a real trooper of a writer and editor. And he said in one of his articles, he said, isn't it a shame that people in this country do not know what a rhododendron is, but people in England grow them because they love them?
Yeah, the rhododendron is a mystery why it took so long to take off. Same with the hydrangea, for that matter. But the hydrangea is English, right?
Hydrangea comes from other exotic places.
Okay.
It certainly is a plant that we love today. We have native hydrangea, for example, the oak leaf hydrangea, which is a wonderful hydrangea. But a lot of the other hydrangeas that we grow in this country are really products from other cultures. And we now import them and grow them in our own gardens.
You know, as we mentioned earlier, there were lots of styles of gardening that were influencing the English and therefore us. But especially as our nation became the proverbial melting pot with styles from Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and France, and so forth, why did English take precedence? What was the magic there? It was simply what was marketed?
I think that's the major reason. But also, it's a rather simple style that people could replicate pretty easily without spending a great deal of money. I remember this story that I heard about a property in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, especially in the Milwaukee area, had a great deal of German immigrants in the 19th century. And Mr. Vick put out a German publication of his catalog, and it appealed to this group, of course. And when they gardened in Wisconsin at that time, they knew how to garden from their experience in Germany. But when they came here, they wanted to have the kind of vegetable patches that Mr. Vick showed in his catalog. And there, because he was a true lover of the English style, he showed vegetables in straight lines. And that's what they wanted to do, even though the German experience of growing veggies was quite different from that in groupings that were not always straight. But they wanted to have this American version of gardening because it was one that was in the catalog that would make them feel more American. So the catalogs really had a great deal of influence. And there was no other way to know how to garden really from outside your home except these catalogs. Just think of all the resources we have today. And people would receive these catalogs in the springtime and then they'd be just enthralled with the imagery in them and want to copy what they saw, wanted to grow what they saw, especially once color came on the scene.
Well, once the retail aspect of selling became big, that's when the seed packets became big, right?
Exactly. They became a little bit bigger, and they also multiplied. But I did find this, that a lot of the seed companies sold the same thing. Mm-hmm. They were selling the same plants, sometimes getting seeds from the same source. They didn't. Most of them didn't grow all their own seeds, but they certainly had more offerings as the century wore on. And they always had, in the beginning of the catalog, the newest and the latest, because people always love that. They love the new plants. I'm a gardener, so I know that you're always looking for what's the newest thing, so you want to try that out. So we did, at the beginning of each catalog, they always had the novelty plants. And sometimes that plant would be there for 1 year, the next year it would be gone, and you wouldn't see it anyplace. Sometimes you'd see another plant that was a novelty, the next year be in the catalog. So it didn't always make it, but it was new. That's what people liked.
I enjoyed that at the end of each chapter you had included a featured plant from your own garden. And how would you describe your own garden?
Well, I have I'm what's called a collector garden. There are two kinds of gardeners. The first kind is the gardener who has a landscape that is pre-thought, that is designed in a way that you have a feeling of unison in all the components of the garden. So as you walk through it, you're kind of surprised at this. You don't see it all at once. That's an old English version of landscape gardening, where you're surprised at elements in it, and it's thought out. It's taken as a whole. My garden is what's called a garden of collections. I have plants here. I have plants there that I've put together in smaller gardens. I have a white garden, a blue garden, and a yellow garden. So I have purposely chosen plants just for those areas. So, and then people will give me a plant or send me a plant, and then I have to figure out where I'm going to put it, then I put it there. So I'm what's called a collector. Those are the two kinds of gardeners.
I suppose a lot of that is dictated by how much sun or shade you have.
Exactly, and I have a lot of shade. I have a lot of shade. That's why I grow a lot of hostas, because I have a lot of shade.
Me too. But I don't have as much sun, so I cram everything into one big garden.
Okay.
Because
okay.
Well, I like color too.
You're probably a collector then. When you talk about cramming, that means you have a plant
and you have
to find space for it.
I'm a collector.
Yeah, that's what a collector
it's
is.
It's like, oh, look in there behind the hosta. There's, you know, that and that and that. Yeah, you know.
And the English would often comment on that, the collection, to go see the collection. And in fact, in the 1700s, many gardeners in England would have what was called an American garden, and it was a collection of plants that were native to America. They loved that, so that was a special garden within the whole landscape. It was called the American garden.
Right. I mean, the English wanted American plants. I mean, back in the day, the exchange of seeds and plants was a really big deal. It's how people made friendships over years. They may never have met each other, but they had each other's plants.
Exactly, exactly. And there were people like John Bartram from Philadelphia who was trying desperately to get native plants accepted here. He was a proponent of native plants from the beginning, but they were more accepted by his English friends, it seems, and he would send them seeds, and they would send him things. And he also worked with a couple of people at Williamsburg, John Barton, but he's an early proponent of native plants. But his voice was kind of alone in the wilderness, as it were.
Well, you know, the grass is always greener.
Exactly.
As they say. My guest is Tom Mickey. He's the author of a new book. It's called America's Romance with the English Garden. We'll continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, how the Defense Department's payroll system is failing U.S. soldiers. We talk with reporter Scott Paltrow about his Reuters series, investigating how an accounting system set up in the 90s, and which still uses antiquated computers, is underpaying or wrongfully penalizing soldiers. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
You're mobile, and we are too. 89.7 NPR News is now available anytime, anywhere with the WOSU Public Media mobile app. Get your headlines on demand, listen to live streaming of 89.7, and your favorite podcasts like All Sides with Ann Fisher, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered. It's free and available for iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. Just go to wosu.org/mobile app and download the app today.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Okay, now you know when you hear this music from Downton Abbey that you're visualizing the outside of the castle, not the inside. You're looking at the expansive lawn, the classic English garden, and that is what has influenced our own love of the lawn. According to Tom Mickey, my guest, he's the author of America's Romance with the English Garden. If you have a question or comment for Tom, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Lois on Facebook says that FYI, the U.S. Postal Service currently is offering first-class stamps with historical flower art based on vintage seed packets. So that's kind of cool. Let's see. Jeff in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, listen, this program today is right up my alley. I was actually in the garden this morning. I live in German Village, where, you know, we are garden crazy
and
competitive. And heard the theme from Downton Abbey. So my question for Tom is, what does he think the influence of home and garden programs have been on the American gardener? Programs like Victory Garden, which I, you know, was addicted to 30 years ago.
I was going to say, that goes way back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I mean, it just opened up, you know, so many opportunities and all of our eyes to, you know, what we could do. And I'd be interested to hear about, you know, the influence of programs like that.
Well, in my book, I really don't talk about the 20th century, but I can respond to it from what happened at the end of the 19th century, that for the first time, the media dictated how people were to garden, and they checked that as their reference point, what the garden looked like in the catalog, and also in garden magazines and in garden books, which also went along with that message from the catalog. I must say this, that Dave's garden network, Dave's Garden, that huge internet resource is also important for a lot of gardeners today. So we depend on the internet today. The Victory Garden was important in its period, and also books from that. We always look outside of ourselves for some reference point on how we might garden, how we might improve our landscape. And so for the first time, we were able to do that on a mass scale and for everybody. Before that, before the 1890s, it was really just for the very wealthy, for those who were well-educated. But by the end of the century, with mass education in America, there was this resource that everybody then could check out.
Jeff, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have an email from Cynthia in Columbus. She writes, every year I purchase a new calendar from the Smithsonian that features the artwork from the covers of gardening catalogs in the late 1800s, early 1900s. They feature glorious pictures of tomatoes, many other veggies, roses, zinnias, tulips, all the fun garden flowers. At the end of the year, I tear out the pictures and plaster them on my garage wall, which is where my garden stuff is located. So inspiring. Unfortunately, most of those seed companies are gone, along with their beautiful artwork.
What a wonderful thing to do, though, so she remembers the artwork.
I love that idea. It's making me think about my garden shed right now.
It's a wonderful thing to do. In the 19th century, there were some company owners who would often say this, because they were quite competitive. They would say, our catalog does not include all that colorful artwork, which is really deceiving, because a plant never looks like that anyway. As if to say, buy from us because we don't charge as much because our catalogs are simpler. It was a wonderful argument.
Because we're boring and cheap?
Yeah, they were plain and simple. Those are the words they use, kind of the same meaning. But they were plain and simple. They didn't have all that color in it. So any argument that they could use in trying to persuade the gardener is what they used, and that was one of them. Also, the size of the catalog. You don't need all these pages. In just a few pages, you will see what we have available. They would, countering what other people were doing.
How much does the English soil differ from American soil, and how did that influence Americans' ability to adapt classic English gardening fare here?
Well, I want to speak about the soil, the climate. The climate is the most important element in the English garden, where you were able to have this lawn almost the whole year, the whole summer, and beautiful green lawn in England because of the climate, where it's located. In this country, people tried to have the lawn across the country from these catalogs, and it became harder and harder to do so. In Arizona, in California, for example, to try to have a lawn, even in Utah, to try to have a lawn like we have in New England. Remember, these catalogs are traveling the country.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, the nurserymen who have companies on the East Coast open up a branch of their company on the West Coast. Within a very short period of time, they realize a lot of these plants aren't going to make it here. And so they still have that English garden design, but with more plants that are appropriate to that climate. But the lawn is probably the greatest drain on resources for us to keep that English garden look today.
If you have a question or comment for Tom Mickey, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. When did gardening get to be so competitive in England? I tried to get a cut from Wallace and Gromit, The Case of the Were-Rabbit, but I just couldn't find the right cut. It's hysterical. It's a satire on the English garden competitions and
yes.
So forth. But when did it get like that there?
Well, in the early 1800s, there was always competition for tulips, for dahlias, for people who would grow the biggest and the best, and they would have awards. And that was something that we copied, of course, in this country as well, so that your gardening really was shown by status was illustrated by how many awards you received. That was really from the beginning. It was very common, for example, with the estate owners in the early 1700s to visit the gardens or the landscape of other people to see what they could do and how they might copy or imitate what they did, because they really didn't have any media forms other than actually visiting the site. So that also became a way of gardening, the way that they might think about gardening. In fact, Thomas Jefferson visited England and had as his guide Observations of a Gardener, which was a very important book in the 1700s, which illustrated the great gardens of England. And so he would visit as many of these gardens as he could to get ideas from the book and from actually walking the property for his property at Monticello.
You mentioned that the lawn issue here is a problem because of runoff from chemicals, the water shortages in many places. I remember when I lived in Phoenix, it was ridiculous how many people had lawns and how much they were watering in 112-degree heat. Now, a lot of that's changing in the Southwest. The more naturalized garden is coming into vogue. for necessary reasons. But in England, it's not necessary. But is that lawn still a real mark of the middle class there?
Well, I must say this. The fellow that I told you about that I talked to in England a couple of weeks ago, and he said, I'm obsessed with my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
I had him explain it. He said, I spend more time on my lawn outside than anything else I do in my leisure time. I said, why? He said, it gives me great pleasure to see this green swath of outside my house. He just loves it. So this is kind of deeply embedded in the English psyche and also probably in our psyche.
Do you see it in contemporary building and neighborhoods and suburbs? Is the lawn still a big part there as it is here?
It's still, I did see it quite extensively there. I did see it, and I was mm-hmm. really surprised to hear people talk about how important it was. But I must say here in the States, especially here on the East Coast, we're moving away from these large lawns.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now creating smaller lawns and creating, for example, beds of perennials on the lawn so you don't have to cut all of that,
mm-hmm.
introducing native plants. People are doing that more and more, even though recently I interviewed some landscapers, people who do landscape, you know, cutting of the grass and trimming as a business, four or five of them. I interviewed separately, and I asked them, what's the position of the green lawn for people today? Do they still want it? The number one issue today is the lawn. People still mm-hmm. want that green lawn. They're more open to using natural remedies to take care of weeds and so forth, but
mm-hmm.
they're still interested in having this lawn. They just cannot get rid of that idea of having a green lawn.
The English were the first to develop the idea of the park. In fact, that's what they called their lawns or their yards, was the park, and then the public park, right?
Exactly, the park, so that your property would have this park look effect. And it was really a kind of a landmark moment where people saw that you could look outside your windows and see this extensive view of lawn and then trees in the background, very soothing and calming, which is really a great idea. That, of course, is the design that Olmsted used in Central Park. He used this romantic English garden design in his thinking and his work there.
Do you see this influence that we've been talking about this hour across the country?
Well, it did in the 19th century. Denise Adams, in her book, a very extensive book on plants from the 19th century, says the same garden appeared across the country, though it appeared often with plants more appropriate for that area. So that the same in the 19th century, the garden style, the garden design was pretty much the same all the way across the country. And I argue in the book that that's due to the marketing strategy of the catalogs, because people didn't have any other reference. They only had this to guide them, and of course what the nurserymen told them, and they were really preeminent marketers and sellers.
When did they start zoning?
Zoning?
Did the catalogs ever zone?
No, the catalogs don't really talk about that. They do talk about regions of the country.
Okay.
They do talk about that and what's going to be appropriate for your area. But they do, for example, in his magazine, Thomas Meehan's magazine, Gardeners Monthly, he always has at the beginning of his magazine, which came out for all those years, he always has a lesson about the lawn, what you're supposed to do about the lawn. And this catalog went across the country. So January, February, whatever the month was, he always gave you what you're supposed to do for your lawn at this time. He never said, if you're in the Southwest, do this, or if you're in the Southeast, do this. It was like everybody had the same kind of instruction.
When did gardening magazines, I guess, they probably took real hold once the gardening catalogs weren't necessary anymore?
Well, the garden magazines, the first big one is in the United States is in about 1830 in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And then Thomas Meehan's is 1869. His is the next big one. The garden catalogs did appear, but they magazines rather, but they reflected the English style of garden magazines. So they'd be articles by the publisher or the editor, and then always contributions from somebody who would send in a piece, and that would fill up most of the magazine, which is what happened. But they became important all along, but they increased after 1880 when the catalogs became more extensive. Then you had more popular garden magazines, most of which didn't really last very long. But you had them pretty much all through this period, just more of them by the end of the century.
So there's just a few big seed manufacturers, or I should say retailers now.
Oh, there are. Of these that were around in the 19th century, there are really quite few of them.
Compared.
Landreth is still there. Burpee is still here. Those are the two big ones that are here in America that still have a business going, even though they've gone through various kinds of... And Comstock, too. I'm sorry, that's been rebought.
Why didn't more of them survive if gardening never let... Gardening's never let up as a popular pastime?
Well, I think part of the reason is it became quite competitive. For example... Burpee bought out Vic. Vic could no longer survive because he was a much smaller company. Other companies became bigger and bigger and bigger. So I think that competitiveness, that drove out the Shakers. Originally, the Shakers were the ones in the late 1700s who came up with the idea of the seed envelope, which was a humongous marketing strategy, and we owe that to them at the end of the 1700s here in America, the beginning of the 1800s. But what happened when these commercial seed companies and nurseries came along, especially by the mid-19th century, they really couldn't compete because of all the marketing strategies that these other companies used. And so they continued to sell, but they didn't have quite as big a mark on the field as they could have.
When did the big nurseries, as we think of them now, come around where people could go shopping at the nursery?
Well, you could always go there. For example, Mr. Vick and Mr. Henderson, let me use Peter Henderson. Peter Henderson had a seed store in Manhattan, in New York, and you could go to visit him and buy your seeds on the first floor. He sold dahlia, tubers, and all kinds of bulbs on that first floor, seeds, bulbs, and tubers. And on the second, third, fourth, and fifth floors were where the orders for his seeds were received, where they were filled, where they were stashed until they were mailed, and then the top floor was where all the seeds and bulbs were stored. So you could actually visit them. You could visit in Rochester the Ellwanger and Berry Nursery, which was a very important nursery in the 19th century, if you wanted, but most people didn't because they lived so far away.
How did you get interested in this? Obviously, you're a gardener, and I mentioned earlier, you know, you are a graduate of Harvard University's Landscape Institute, but what about this connection between the English garden and the American tradition?
Well, I got interested in it because in my teaching, I teach the history of marketing and advertising, and in that course, what happens is that we examine campaigns to see what kinds of cultural values the campaign is selling. When people sell any product, it isn't just the product. For example, there are 350 toothpastes on the market, but the ones that get our attention are the ones that sell us. We're going to look, have a brighter smile, we're going to be happier, we're going to get our partner, whatever message they use to persuade us. Those are the ones we buy. So by looking at the cultural values of products, we understand a great deal of the culture. So I was kind of interested in that general field. And then as a gardener, I decided to write a proposal to the Smithsonian and study the question of how the marketing in the 19th century sold us values connected with gardening. And the Smithsonian loved the project and offered me a fellowship, and I went down there for a whole year. And, of course, when you look at marketing the garden in the 19th century, the only thing you can look at is catalogs.
Tom Mickey, thank you. I have to end it there, but thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Tom Mickey, he's author of America's Romance with the English Garden. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.